In order to get there at all, we need to discuss a little bit of string theory. So if you have taken a course on string theory, good for you. If you haven't, I will just draw maybe 6 cartoons, which will tell you everything you need to know about string theory, okay? And so the cartoon number one. So first of all, string theory, as I said, is a quantum theory of relativistic strings and other possibly higher dimensional objects. So let's start with the classical case. So no quantum, but what the relativistic strings are, and we know that they are simply extended objects, which are extended in one direction. And then as they move in the space-time, they sweep out the trajectory, which is called worksheet. And this worksheet inherits some metric, which is induced from the metric in the space-time where the string moves. So for simplicity, we started with strings which were moving in Minkowski spacetime, equipped with the metric eta mu nu, and the coordinates in this Minkowski spacetime are x mu. Okay, so this is where everything happens in this Minkowski spacetime, and in that case, the induced metric on this worksheet on this sheet, which is caused by the motion of the string, is simply given by projecting this Minkowski metric using these projectors. So this is a projector P mu A, and it's really what it does is it projects this metric onto that worksheet, and you have to project each index, so they have 2 of these projectors, and then you have the induced metric over here. Of course, the worksheet is described by two coordinates, lambda and sigma, and the motion really is characterized by saying, what is my x mu as a function of these lambda and sigma, right? So that's how the motion is described. And you can derive the equations of motion from the corresponding action. And so there's this very nice geometric one, which is the Nambu-Goto action, which basically tells you I extremize the volume of this worksheet. So the volume of the worksheet is simply given by the determinant of the metric. And so this has very nice geometric interpretation, where T is the tangent of the string. And it's customary to parameterize it in terms of the parameter alpha prime. And if you look at this, so of course, the metric is dimensionless, determinant as well. So now this has dimensions of length square, this integral. And in order the whole action to be dimensionless, you have to have that the T has dimensions of 1 over length square, which is precisely what I'm writing here. And there will be some characteristic length scale associated with the string. So basically, you can think about LS as something like the length of the string, but it's some characteristic length scale characterizing your theory. All right, so that's one way to do that. And then in your tutorial yesterday, you showed that there's another classically equivalent action which you can write down, and that's the Polyakov action. So now the Polyakov action is not only function of these x mu's, but it's also a function of this auxiliary metric on the worksheet. So it's a metric which lives, it has these indices A and B, so lives in this two-dimensional space-time. And the action reads like this. So again, this is our induced metric, which we already know. And what is very nice about this action is that it no longer has the square root, and so it will be easily quantized. Okay. So now, let me just, if you look at this thing here, right? So it looks very simple, but it's actually even more simple than when you start thinking what, when you plug in what the gamma AB is, and then you will see that what it is well, okay. So if I write an action, which if you were doing some field theory course, you would be writing an action something like this, nabla B phi, and then HAB, and square root of H, then what will be this action for? It will be a scale, right? So D square psi. So this will be just simply a scalar field living in 2 dimensions, right? Which is coupled to some curve metric HAB, okay? So now, what if I put some index mu here, and then some index mu here, right? What would that be? it would be still an action for the scalar field living in two dimensions. However, now the scalar field, there will be more scalar fields. There will be scalar fields running from mu 0 to mu equal to d or something like that in the Minkowski spacetime. This is precisely what's written over here, right? So now I write it in this way, eta mu nu, right? So this is what I had before. So this is really, you know, d scalar fields in two dimensions. Okay, and if you look at this thing here, and you look at what the gamma AB is, well, it's precisely that. Except now I call these scalar fields x instead of phi. So what the Polyakov action really is an action for, you know, d scalar fields, x mu, which live in two-dimensional space and are coupled to this curve metric HAB. It's an action. This is an action for 2D scalar fields or scalars. Okay? So there cannot be anything more simple than that, right? And it's just you know, a couple of scalar fields coupled to curve metric in two dimensions. Right? Well, there is something nice about, and these scalar fields are, of course, massless. There is no mass term, right? But there's something super nice about two dimensions. And do you know what that is regarding the scalar field theory?
It's conformal.
It's conformal, okay? So what conformal means is that if I rescale my metric h to omega square h, right, then it can be shown that this action remains invariant. So it has a very particular symmetry, which is called conformal symmetry. So 2D scalars, scalar theory has beautiful symmetry, which is the conformal symmetry. Okay, so which means that if I rescale h to omega square h, then the action remains invariant. Leaves. Okay, and how can you show that? Well, if you do this, then of course the determinant of the metric will also change, right? So HAB, so this is like HAB to HAB. Okay, so now if I do inverse metric, how does that change? If h with indices down changes like this, if it has indices up, it changes like. Sorry, it's the same. It's an inverse metric. You have to invert it, so it's omega minus two. HAB, right? Okay, so now how does the determinant changes? So if you have determinant of h, so it's a 2x2 matrix, right? So blah blah blah, I multiply by omega square, which means I'm multiplying by omega square each component of that matrix. Okay, if I calculate the determinant, well, there will be omega square here, so the determinant will go like omega 4 to the original determinant. But if I take square root of that, it goes like omega square. So h goes like omega square h. Okay? Now we'll plug it there. So you have square root of h, it's like omega square. HAB with indices upstairs goes like omega minus square. And you just prove that this has a conformal symmetry. Okay? But what is also obvious from this derivation is that this will work only in two dimensions. Right? If I am in three dimensions, well, I still do the same thing here. H changes like this, this changes like that. But now this is a 3x3 matrix, right? So I will have omega square, omega square, omega square, so omega 6. If I take square root of that, it's omega cube, and it will not cancel anymore. So this is really only in 2D. That's very, very important. Okay, so the scalar theory has this conformal.
Can you just change the exponent for
3D or no?
Well, if you start changing everything, it depends what you want to do, right? But conformal symmetry is I just keep messing with the metric, okay? So that's what Weyl symmetry. Sometimes people distinguish conformal symmetry from the Weyl symmetry. Maybe we'll have to distinguish later in the course as well. So this is more like Weyl symmetry, which just changes the metric and doesn't do anything with anything else.
Oh.
Okay.
Is that the definition of Weyl symmetry?
That's the definition of the Weyl symmetry. Okay, let's put well, whatever. Let's leave conformal symmetry there. Okay? So this action has this super nice classical symmetry, which is the conformal symmetry. Okay, so we've done this relativistic strings at the classical level. Are there questions? So now let's do quantum superstrings. And so basically what you do is that you quantize the theory given by this action, by the Polyakov action. But because we know that the Polyakov action is nothing else than the action for the scalar field, what will be the corresponding equation of motion? It will be boson phi equals to zero. Boson phi is a wave equation. So this thing here will have solution as waves propagating this or that direction in two dimensions. And everybody knows how to quantize waves, right? So you just write the Fourier expansion. There will be some coefficients. And then you put hats on these coefficients, and you impose canonical commutation relations. And that's how you quantize the theory, OK? So let me give you the result. So this is quantize Polyakov action or Polyakov action. However, is this word superstring? So this will be true for strings. Is this word super, which is related to supersymmetry, okay? And so basically, in order to describe, so this thing here wouldn't have any fermions, and we know that in our world there are some fermions, so you need to include fermions as well, and you include them in supersymmetric way for some reason. So Polyakov supplemented. Fermions, and this is done in the supersymmetric way. So you have the same number of degrees of freedom in fermions as you have the same number of in bosons, and that's what a quantum superstring is. Okay, so basically what you do is that you take that action and put there like a Dirac term or something like that, and it still lives in two dimensions, and that's it. Okay, so now you have to worry about boundary conditions, right? So typically, you can have open strings, and you may be asking, like, what is the boundary condition here? What is the boundary condition here? Is it Dirichlet? Is it Naumann? Is it whatever? Right? It's the same for fermions, right? For fermions, I have to think about what are the boundary conditions and like that. So consequently, you get different theories. Choosing different boundary conditions for these strings, you get different theories. And there's many string theories. There's string theory 1, type 2, 2a, 2b, and stuff like that. So there's this few consistent theories. So this leads to a few consistent theories. Based on what boundary conditions you choose. And so, of course, you can have open strings, but you can also have closed strings, which are like which form like that. Okay. So, what is the result of the quantization? Is our carton number 2? Carton 2. And basically, if you have open string, well, this open string sort of can carry some fundamental mode like this. So, this is an open string, and this fundamental mode. After you quantize it, will contain some vector field A mu typically. So there will be some field associated with this mode, which you get by pushing the creation operator on the vacuum, creation operator will have the index mu, which lives in this space-time here, and so there will be some vector field associated with an open string. So then you can have closed string, which is perhaps more interesting. So then there will be some fundamental mode for the closed string, okay, and that object will have two indices, and any matrix with two indices you can decompose into symmetric part, antisymmetric part, and the trace or whatever.
Are you drawing these as a slice in time or?
This is just a cartoon. So let's not imagine that I have a vibrating string, right? So this is my vibrating string.
If you were, say, kind of drawing a diagram like up there where you have time included, it would be more like a sheet? Or
so then it would be drawing like, I don't know. So if you do this, then it would be like a vibrating string like that or like that. And then later on, it will be moving somewhere else. And
oh, so what's that thing supposed to be? If that's because, like, cartoon one, like, one string, but then
it's moving in time. Exactly.
Okay.
So there will be some particle vibration, let's say, at a given instant of time, and then as you evolve, the string moves somewhere else, but also the vibration changes, of course.
Okay, so it would still look like a sheet in that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, this is still true, right? This is yeah.
Okay.
Right? So now you have a matrix, T mu nu, but you can decompose it into symmetric, antisymmetric, and trace part. Okay? Correspondingly, you get the symmetric part is the graviton, the antisymmetric part is an antisymmetric two form, okay? And then you have the trace. Okay, so this guy is the graviton. This guy is the Kalman-Ramon field. And this guy is called the Dilaton. It's like a scalar field. Okay? And so this is what you find after you quantize these. Yes?
Can you repeat why is it a matrix in the closed case?
Why is it? Well, it's something like, well, it has to do. Okay, so when you quantize these things, right? So basically, you have wave equation, but it's not only that, you have some constraints. So which comes like you have to vary the field H as well, which is what you did yesterday, and you find that the T mu nu is zero, TAB is zero corresponding to that. So that gives you some constraints. But also you impose these boundary conditions. And so basically what happens is something like you can think about the closed string as open string square. Okay, so this is something like this is true. So you know, whenever you act on the open string once, you have to act on the closed string twice, and so that's why you pop up another index, basically. So this is, yeah, okay. I didn't write that, okay? So you have these beautiful fields, which are the characteristic vibrations of your string, but the graviton is among them, okay? And this is beautiful, right? You just quantize something, a relativistic string, and you find that graviton is in the spectrum of that string. So it means you have quantum theory of gravity. We have. So string theory is a quantum theory of gravity. It may not be the theory of quantum gravity, which we are looking for, but it is certainly one quantum theory of gravity. Yes?
Do people quantize number water as well and to get then the same result?
It's a very good, interesting question. They are classically equivalent, but I think there are papers, well, people are still debating this, and I think I've seen recently even papers that where they say that not necessarily it's equivalent at the quantum level. So hard to say. So certainly, you know, this action is easy to quantize, so people use this action most of the time, but it's a very interesting question whether these two actions actually at the quantum level would be equivalent necessarily or not, and there doesn't seem to be a consensus at this point. So it's a research problem, okay? Okay, so we have a theory of quantum gravity, but there's one more problem here, and the problem is, well, you know that the graviton better be massless, okay? So if graviton is not massless, we are screwed, and if it's a massive gravity, you know that there's many more degrees of freedom. So you know that in four dimensions, graviton has two degrees of freedom, polarization like this and like that, right? However, if you had massive graviton, it would have 5 degrees of freedom. It would be much more complicated, right? So what you find by quantizing these things, that this really has the right number of degrees of freedom as the massless graviton should have, but only in certain number of space-time dimensions. And this fixes the number of dimensions of this Minkowski space-time here for this eta mu nu and x mu to d equal to 10. Okay, so we have a quantum theory of gravity, but unfortunately it's not our quantum theory of gravity in 4 dimensions, but it is actually, it has to live in 10 dimensions. Okay, otherwise, this would be inconsistent, right, with a massless graviton. Okay.
Graviton is massless because it's conformal?
I don't know. So what you will find is that, you know, this. So you start with this matrix T mu nu, right? You can decompose it always into these things here. And then what you find that this G mu nu, I don't know how many degrees of freedom has graviton in 10 dimensions, but if you were in 4 dimensions, right, you would find that this thing here has only 2 polarizations. Then you know it's symmetric, it has 2 polarizations, you know it has to be graviton, and you know it has to be massless. So then the question is, how can I make this massless? So you can calculate what the mass of this object is, and the mass of that object depends on the number of dimensions. It's only massless in d equal to 10 dimensions. Okay, so the theory is inconsistent if you are in any other dimension. Right, because otherwise you would find that a polarization, well, with these 2 polarizations, graviton has a mass, which is not true. Right, it would be a massive gravity and it would have to have more polarizations.
Schematically, how does this calculation change when you're not in the supersymmetric theory? Because then it would be like
6. I don't know. So people always consider, well, okay. So if you don't put fermions at all, you just consider bosonic string theory, right? So you just start with this action. You don't put fermions whatsoever. Then it finds that it's 26, okay? So then you have to be even higher dimensions, okay? So that's one answer. Second answer, here we're quantizing in the flat space. Okay, so we are putting our strings to live in flat space. However, as we will discuss now, you don't need to quantize in flat space. You can start with a different background, which is maybe more reasonable. And the presence of, you know, other fields in this background can slightly alter this thing here. Okay, so this is true if you quantize strings in the flat space, and if you have fermions.
Are there any restrictions as to whether those dimensions are compactified or macroscopic?
So at this point, everything is nice and flat Minkowski. So, you know, why people want to compactify is that, of course, we see only 4 dimensions, right? So, you know, where are the other 6 dimensions? And so people say, well, they are too small to see. So that's why you have to compactify them on a small thing. And so, you know, that's when you start worrying about phenomenology, like how this actually fits into our universe, then you have to start compactifying and stuff like that. But the compactification, really, I'm not sure. Does it change the number of dimensions? I don't think so. But you compactify on a given space of given dimensionality, right? So typically, well, that's not true if you are taking d equal to 2 limit of 4-dimensional Einstein theory. You compactify on 0-dimensional space, or whatever. So typically you fix the number of compactified dimensions, right? And so this has nothing to do with changing the total number of dimensions, the compactification. All right, so we have cartoon 2. So we have a theory of quantum gravity. Yes?
So like, from Minkowski space, and the target space is Minkowski space. And then we quantize this thing, and we get, from this whole space, we get something that is symmetric. And then we play to the quantum theory of gravity. So does this mean that this guy, the GPU, satisfies the Aston equations of target space?
Okay, we shall see. Okay, so wait a second, okay? That's the cartoon number 3.
Okay.
So cartoon number 3. So far, it's a very good question. So far, we as you said, we as you summarized, we have Minkowski space. and we have one string in that Minkowski space. So now imagine that you start putting more and more of these strings in the Minkowski space. Each of them carries its own graviton and a dilaton and then a Kalman field and whatever. If you put lots of them there, they probably curve the space-time, and they put some non-trivial matter fields on that space-time, right? So let's imagine we already have many strings. Which possibly, you know, curve the space-time and, you know, introduce non-trivial fields in the space-time. So curve the space-time. As you start putting more and more gravitons, they, you know, curve the space and put some non-trivial fields on there. And want to place one more in that space. Okay. So basically, the cartoon goes like, well, we already know that our space is sort of curved. There's lots of these strings, lots of these gravitons everywhere, right? And so on. So we have non-trivial g mu nu in the space-time. And we have non-trivial phi, and we have non-trivial b mu nu, because there's lots of these things. And we want to place one more string. So you want to place this guy here. On that already curved space. Okay, so that's the cartoon number three. Okay. So now, basically, everything proceeds the same way as we were doing in Minkowski space. However, you might have noticed that when I introduced this gamma AB over there, I put a bracket and put eta, Minkowski metric, right? If you had curved space, if you had G mu nu, well, the induced metric would be exactly the same. I just change eta mu nu to g mu nu. Okay, so that means that my Polyakov action will be the same, but that will be gab of g mu nu, not eta mu nu. Okay, so similarly, you can also couple this. You can couple the string to this non-trivial b mu nu and to the non-trivial dilaton. So what you have to do is that basically the Polyakov action. Polyakov action now changes because we have to couple our string to these non-trivial fields, which are already penetrating my space-time. And so we would have that HAB gamma AB of eta has to be changed to HAB gamma AB of G. And then you also want to be mu nu. So basically, I can overload this operator gamma AB, and I can plug, instead of eta mu nu, I can plug B mu nu. Okay? But B mu nu is antisymmetric. Okay? So B mu nu is antisymmetric thing. So of course, graviton is symmetric here in these two indices. B mu nu is antisymmetric in the two indices. So then, you know, the corresponding gamma AB is antisymmetric in AB, and it cannot couple to HAB, which is symmetric. So it has to couple something antisymmetric. In two dimensions, you have Levitch-Idler symbol, which is antisymmetric. So then the next term will be plus epsilon AB gamma AB of B mu nu. So now this guy is antisymmetric because B mu nu is. This guy is antisymmetric, so it's OK. And then finally, plus alpha prime R of H phi. Okay, so this is how the string now couples to non-trivial background. It no longer lives in Minkowski, and it lives in this background of other strings. And this is the result. Okay, very good. So now what you do is that this is your action, which you are quantizing and whatever. Classically, these actions will still have conformal symmetry. The question is, what will happen at the quantum level? Okay, does the theory still preserve conformal symmetry? So it means, like, let's say I go to a one-loop calculation, right? And at one loop, do I still have conformal symmetry? And you will have, if you have taken any CFT, you know that the conformal symmetry is related to the beta functions, like if you have the RG flow. And then if the beta and your theory remains conformal, if your beta functions are zero. Okay, so then the statement is, once you start quantizing this, the conformal symmetry is preserved at one loop or quantum mechanically if there will be some beta functions, and there will be beta functions corresponding to the metric G, and there will be beta functions corresponding to B and to phi. If beta G is equal to 0, is equal to beta B, is equal to 0, is equal to beta phi. Okay? So if the corresponding beta functions at one level, at one loop, will be 0, then the conformal symmetry is preserved quantum mechanically. Okay, now you can do the calculation. Look it up in David Stone lectures or something like that. Okay? And then what you will find is that this equation here, miracle, 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 is Einstein equation. Okay, this equation here will be some modified, you know, Maxwell equation. And this equation here will be some modified, you know, equation for the scalar field. Okay, so this yields Einstein equations plus other equations for the other fields. Okay, this is crazy, right? Where the Einstein equations, they emerge from preserving the conformal symmetry of your theory at the quantum level. Okay, and this is like so amazing, right? So basically what it means is that you might think, well, I can place my string in any background whatsoever, and it will be a consistent theory. But the statement is, no, I cannot do that. I can place the string only in such a background which satisfies Einstein equations. Yes?
I don't see why we need to check conformal anomaly to get Einstein equation, which is classical. Like, we should be able to get it from some classical theory itself.
Okay. I don't know how. So ask some string theory expert, okay, if it's possible. I don't think it's possible. But this is how really the standard way how the Einstein equations emerge in string theory. It's very weird, right? It's very weird. I agree.
I was going to ask something similar to Vaughn. Can you give intuition for why only imposing the symmetry at one loop is enough to recover the Einstein equation?
Okay. You mean at one loop? Or you're asking why not to second loop? Okay, that's a very good question.
Where you need to everywhere in order to get the Einstein equation.
It's an excellent question, and the answer is because I lied to you. Okay? So what you really do, what you really do is that you recover Einstein equations plus corrections. Okay? If you go to second loop, the corrections, there will be many, many, many more corrections, and this will be alpha prime corrections. Okay? So this is Einstein equations, and if you go to higher loops and stuff like that, you will get corrections to these Einstein equations. Okay? And even I lied to you even more, because you don't really recover Einstein equations. What you recover, let's say you start with, as I said, based on various boundary conditions, you can have various theories, right? One theory which is nice for us is called 2B string superstring theory. Okay? So in 2B superstring theory, the corresponding equation, Einstein equations, which you recover over here, can be derived from an action which is the corresponding 2B supergravity action. Okay? These Einstein equations, Einstein equations, can be derived from 2B supergravity action. Gravity action. And the supergravity action, I'll write it down so that you have an idea. Okay, so what really this supergravity has as field? So I told you, well, there's this dilaton, there's this Carl Bramon field, there's the G mu nu, but the truth is there's actually many more fields than that, okay? There's fermions as well, but there's other fields as well, okay? And so what you really have as a field is that you have the G mu nu, you have the graviton, you have the dilaton, and you have the Carl Bramon field. But that's not everything. You also have something which is called axion. And then you have another two form, antisymmetric, a mu nu. And then you have a four form. So this is the field content of supergravity. So actually, when you do it for the, you know, type D superstring, you not only have these fields, but there'll be actually more fields than this. Okay, and then the corresponding action, the Lagrangian of that action, Hodge star is just the square root of the determinant. So then you have the dilaton here, e to minus 2 phi, and then you have the Einstein-Hilbert term, and then you have the kinetic term for your dilaton. And then you have the field strength for B mu nu. So if B mu nu is a two form, H will be a three form. So it'll be H three square. Okay. And then you have this axion here, which is basically like a scalar field, but you can do a one form, which will be like D of A zero. So that's minus 1/2 f1 square minus 1/2 f3 square. So this goes to f1, this goes to f3, and this goes to f5, the corresponding field strength. Okay, minus 1/2 phi 3 square. Minus 1/4 phi 5 square. And then there is this Chen-Simons term. A4 is that H3 wedge F3. Okay, so that's your action. So you see, it's more complicated than Einstein equation because you have many more fields there. Okay? But basically, it is the important thing is that you do recover the Einstein-Hilbert action from this crazy. Yes?
A0 is the QCD axion, or is it something?
I have no idea.
And A mu nu and the other field? Some physical interpretation.
For me, I always treated this as two-form and four-form. So what is true is that this four-form, the corresponding field strength has to be self-dual. So you live in 10 dimensions, so star F is equal to F. So this guy is self-dual. But, you know, maybe you can give some physical interpretation, but basically what you are saying is that, yeah, well, in 10 dimensions, you can have quantum theory of gravity, which, you know, where the field satisfies something like Einstein equations, but there is these additional fields which are present in your theory so that your theory works. And of course, plus fermions, right? Plus fermions as well, which I don't dare to write. Okay, so we have some good news and bad news, right? So good news is that, yes, we have consistent theory of quantum gravity. Bad news is that, yeah, we have to pay the price. We live in 10 dimensions, and we have many more fields which we don't observe necessarily in nature. Okay, so that's the bad news. Okay. Yes?
I'm a bit confused by how you treat G here. So first you started with a closed string, and you find that the T mu nu, then you want to tensor of it. Symmetric part, you call it G. But this whole thing is on a flat incomplete background. But then you say that you have strings and they curve.
Mm-hmm.
So then you would couple gravitational action to the string action. And then you have a different G, which is the
the background and the different G, which is the adjuvantum of the string. So feels like you're mixing these two things.
Again, so this is a very, very good question. And you can spend many, many, many lectures on this. So if you want to see the details, again, I encourage you to look them up in David Stone's lectures. But basically what he's showing is that, indeed, right, if I have one particular string which has the vibration of G mu nu, so you can take it as a perturbation, like really small contribution of one graviton to your gravitational background. And you can place it there, and this perturbation will actually contribute to the full curved metric. It's like the splitting on, you know, you split the full G mu nu into eta mu nu plus some perturbation, H mu nu. So this is precisely what you are doing here. So you are splitting onto the background. This is your G mu nu background. And then your string carries some small perturbation of this because it vibrates, it contributes. So the full metric now, let's write it this capital G mu nu, will be G mu nu plus, which is the background, plus, let's say, the perturbation from the metric, from the string itself. And so this is then the full metric, right? And so you can show that this is consistent. And so really, like this thing here, when you place it there, it just, you know, teeny tinyly change the background metric. And you can think about it like really doing a small perturbation to the background. But then the resulting metric, it satisfies the Einstein equation or whatever, is the sum of the two. Okay, so it is consistent, although it doesn't seem so.
You have to show that if you have like a background metric, or a metric that satisfies the equations, then you perturb it with the G coming from the string that still satisfies the answer.
Yeah. That will be true, yeah. All right, okay. So that's cartoon number three. Let's speed it up, cartoon number four. So far, we had just the strings, right? But the strings can possibly interact. Okay, so cartoon four, strings can interact. And people, you know, draw these trouser diagrams or whatever, right? So let's say I have one closed string here, and I have another closed string here, and then they merge for some time together, okay, to form a closed string over there. And then after some time, they split again. Okay, so this is how the stringy interaction goes. So now, in the merger of these things, there will be the corresponding interaction constant, G string, okay? At this thing here, there will be the corresponding interaction constant GS for the splitting again, okay? But let's say you can imagine a situation where, you know, this closed string describes a dilaton, let's say. This closed string describes a dilaton. But this guy here, the biggest contribution, will be, let's say, there's a graviton or something like that. Okay, and then this is dilaton and this is dilaton. So what this really is sort of corresponding to in the normal field theory picture is that you have dilaton interacting with a dilaton, exchanging a graviton, and then doing this, okay? So it describes normal gravitational interaction between matter, okay? Okay, but we know that if you exchange graviton, then better G Newton will be involved in this. In 10 dimensions, G10 is involved here, okay? So what we just derived by this analogy is that we know that G10, exchange of the graviton, so this is a graviton exchange, okay, and somehow in the stringy picture, it has to correspond to interacting strings here and splitting strings here, okay? Joining strings here and then. So we have that G10 is proportional to GS square, okay? So now, this GS is a dimensionless quantity, okay? So, but G10 is not. You know that the Newton's constant is dimension full. That's why it's very hard to quantize gravity. So if you put 1 over g Newton in 4 dimensions, well, g Newton goes like leg square or something like that, right? So in fact, if you are in d dimensions, g Newton goes like d minus 2, length to the, not d minus 2. OK? This is dimensionless. This is dimensionless. So I need something which has dimensions of length to power 8. Okay, what it can be is only one thing which it can be in string theory. There's only one thing which characterizes your string, is this alpha prime or LS. Okay, so we just derived that G10 goes like this. Okay, it cannot be anything else. Yes?
Does G10 not have, like, 10 dimensions of length? It only has 8 dimensions of length?
Okay. So you know, how we can quickly arrive at this? Well, let me write it here, right? So the Einstein-Hilbert action remains the same in all dimensions, right? So you always write 1 over GD, and then you have DDX, and then you have the Ricci scalar. The Ricci scale always goes, well, it contains two derivatives. Right, of the metric. Metric is dimensionless, which is scalar contains two derivatives. So this guy always goes like 1 over length square.
Okay.
Right? This guy goes like length to power d. Ld. So this thing over here goes like Ld minus 2. And in order the whole thing be dimensionless, gd has to go like length to d minus 2. Okay? So this is a quick way how to find that really this is the right dimensionality, and so that's it. Okay, so what we are learning is that yes, strings are characterized by one dimensioned full quantity, which is the LS quantity, but they can also interact. So there is this GS interaction. Okay, this GS interaction somehow must be related to the Newtonian gravitational constant as we know it. Right, but so basically the string theory has only two parameters, which is LS and GS, and that's it. There's nothing else. And in fact, the GS actually is not really an independent parameter, but is an expectation value of the dilaton. Okay, so really, but let's treat it as two independent parameters. All you need to know about string theory is just these two numbers: what LS is and what GS is, and that's it. Now we understand fully the string theory. Okay. Very good. However, so now we have done, so we have quantum theory of relativistic strings. Very well, we have done that. And other objects. So we have to do the other objects as well. Okay, and so so the other objects we already encountered in your tutorial. And it's basically, if you don't deal with closed strings, but you deal with the open ones can end somewhere. And you can impose Dirichlet boundary conditions for these open strings. And so they can end on some D brain, Dirichlet brain. Okay. And so this was cartoon number 4. Let's do cartoon number 5, which is exactly the same as you have seen in your tutorial. So basically, if I have an open string, it can end on a brain, which is, so this is a D brain, right? And so it can end over there. And but what does it mean that it ends on the D brain, right? It means that there are certain directions which the string cannot go. So it cannot, the endpoint of the string cannot leave the D brain. Okay? So basically the X mu's in the directions perpendicular to the brain are fixed. Okay? So in this direction, X mu's are fixed they really satisfy the Dirichlet condition in this thing here. So I'm basically fixing the, you know, the value. Let's say this is my x1, right? So I'm fixing the value of x1 to, let's say, 0 or something like that, right? So in this direction, x mu's are fixed. And people rename them for some reason. Okay, and so how they rename them is that they don't call them x mu's anymore, they call them phi's. Okay, so yeah, renamed to phi's. And so there will be like fixed couple of directions which are perpendicular to that plane, right? And so these will be i's. And of course, from the point of view of the brain, these phi's, well, they have nothing to do with the brain. So they really are like perpendicular direction. They are the values of a scalar field. So these are scalars from the point of view of the brain. Scalars from brain viewpoint. Okay. So these are the Dirichlet directions. This looks strange. There. The Dirichlet directions, okay? So let's call them D directions. D directions. However, this guy here, this endpoint here, can freely slide on the brain, okay? So there will be some directions where actually the endpoint can move, right? So I attach a string here. All I demand is that it never leaves that, right? I cannot leave here, but I can freely move like this or whatever, do some circles, travel around. So there will be some other directions where actually I have Neumann boundary conditions, where the string is happy to move. And I don't know what the writing of x is. Well, let's call them xa. XA directions. So these are the Neumann directions. And in these directions, the string can move. Okay. So now, how do you see this endpoint of the string from the point of view of an observer who is sitting on the brain? Right? So you just see this point here moving. It's a point, and it's moving in the brain. It looks like a point particle moving on that word of my brain. Okay? So this endpoint looks like a particle from brain viewpoint and can move in XA directions. So basically it can move anywhere on the brain in principle. Okay. So we have a particle on the brain. The endpoint of the string looks like a particle moving on the brain. What is also true is that this endpoint can be charged. It could be charged. Or actually, it is charged. So we have a charged particle moving on the brain. And as such, the charged particle can interact with a vector field living on the brain. Okay, so can interact with a vector field on the brain. Okay. This is how you recover normal electromagnetism on these D-brains. Okay, so once you have D-brains, right, you can start making connections with point particles, which are charged particles, and these charged particles can interact with vector fields. And this is the picture over here. So really you should be thinking like this endpoint is charged, and then it can move on the brain, and it can couple to some vector field living on that brain. Yes?
Like this with a closed string?
Yes, exactly. You cannot. So closed string is closed. It doesn't end anywhere. That's why I draw here like a mu here and then the g mu there. So really, they are different, right? So g mu, well, closed strings typically describe graviton, and it's not tied to any D brain or anything like that. You know, this closed string just travels anywhere in the space time. It goes through this D brain if you want. Well, this thing here can end on the D brain, and so it can describe the vector field and normal Maxwell thing and stuff like that. So yes? Yeah, sorry.
What do you mean by a field? Because I usually think of string theory as a particle theory, where you have a string which evolves in time. There is no string field theory, but now you have a field which lives in the brain. Usually, I would think of a field as a section from space-time manifold to some abstract space, but this field lives on the brain.
So basically, you know, what you can think about in very late terms is that, you know, there's this characteristic vibration of the string a mu, which is like a vector field living in the full space-time, right? So now I take this a mu and I decompose it into the directions which are perpendicular to the brain, which will look like, so they won't have, So if you project this a mu onto the directions perpendicular to the brain, that this will not carry any vector index from the brain point of view. So that will be scalars, right? If you project down to the brain, that will be a vector field on the brain. So
fields are excitations of quantized string.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the component along the deep brain are vector.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah. That's exactly what's happening. Isn't this fun? Okay, who is not having fun? Okay, so now we are out of time. Let me just write down the corresponding action for this D brain. Okay, and the action is again what you would guess. It must be, right? Let's just use the Nambu-Goto type action. Why not? Right. So if we have free brain, it's just determinant of gamma AB, right? However, this D brain can have these, you know, vector fields and stuff like that. So there will be some modification of this Nambu-Goto action due to the presence of other fields. Similarly, as we modify the Polyakov action like this, here we will modify the Nambu-Goto action for the presence of other fields. Okay, so this action is called Dirac-Born-Infeld action. Okay, so the motion, or maybe as it's last 2 minutes, I'll just write it in a separate blackboard. So the motion of a single D brain is governed by Dirac born Infeld action. So S D B I. So everybody thinks Dirac was a serious man, right? But he really laid foundations of these Nambu-Goto actions and stuff like that, and motion of these extended objects. And so people in string theory, they love him, right? So, okay. And Born, you know Born? Infeld was, I think, a student of Einstein. And so Born Infeld, not in electrodynamics. I can give you a separate lecture on this, what it means. But it was invented like in 1930s. And it was only 100 years later it was realized it's useful for string theory. Well, that's not true, 50 years later. Okay. So anyway, SDBI. And so it's minus TDP. Let's say we have p-dimensional D brain. So it's this thing here. So we have D xi p plus 1. And then we have minus determinant of gamma AB of our metric, now curve metric, right? But we have also the B field, so gamma AB of the B field, and we have also the Maxwell field. Okay, so plus 2 pi alpha prime F AB, and that's it, like that. But there's also the dilaton, and the dilaton stands in front of that, or at the end of that. It's e to the minus phi. So this is the action which now governs the motion of the D-brain, which is like the Nambu-Goto action, but now the D-brain is no longer free, but it's, you know, it has some additional fields in it, so it's in a curve thing, and it has the B mu nu background, and there's some Maxwell background FAB as well. Okay, so now if you kill this part and you kill that part, this is the Born-Infeld action formulated in the 30s of the last century, and it's a nonlinear electrodynamics. It's a generalization of Maxwell theory, which has so many nice properties I can tell you about in the tutorial or whatever, right? But this is the action governing the motion of a single DP brain. So let me stop here. Questions?
Is alpha prime like the charge?
Sorry. So very good. So this will somehow be related to the Young-Mills coupling. Yes, 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 it will be. We'll see next time, OK? Wait. but certainly, this alpha prime is that alpha prime over there. Right, but it will be related to the Young-Mills coupling or to the Maxwell coupling. Yes, Maxwell charge. More questions?
Do you have any sort of intuition as for why adding fermions to the action reduces the number of dimensions to move?
Intuitively, I don't know. Is there any intuitive? Does anybody know if there is any intuitive explanation? Certainly it's good, right? So 26 dimensions is really too many. So 10 dimensions is still too many, but it's slightly better. but yeah, I don't know.
Other things we can add to reduce the dimension further.
So certainly, you know, by placing, I mean, really this D equal to 10 also depends on the field content. It's true in Minkowski space. And I think if you you put some very, very strong fields, maybe you could alter that. I think it's true. Okay, very good. So next week, finally. We'll need one more thing about the string theory, but then we're done and we have everything ready for the ADS-CFT conjecture. Okay, have a nice weekend.